nature and by genetics. If you take my gene, my DNA, you'll be an astronomer. Whereas all your particle physics and stuff. So I try to keep this as astronomically as possible, but also as you know, as lower at a level that you that might not get totally lost. And if you do, just stop me and we can have a quick conversation. So let's start with the dwarf galaxies. And what are dwarf galaxies? This is actually a dwarf galaxy. You don't see it here. I guess Brian knows a dwarf galaxy. It's a little overdensity of stars over here. Very, very, very faint. That is Dursa Minor, Dursa Riddle. Almost impossible to see, you know, even in a picture. Just an overdensity of stars at a particular distance. These are very difficult objects to see, and it gives you already a quick you know, idea that doing almost anything with this kind of galaxy is actually quite tricky. And the idea is to use them now as cosmological probes. So talk about cosmology. Let's start with this iconic picture from Planck, which tells you the microwave sky. And of course, you know, behind the Milky Way, we have the cosmic microwave background, where you know, the trove of information about our universe, the content in particular of the universe. For the things that we are interested in here, let's suffice it to say that you know, the analysis of Planck and of course of many other you know, large-scale structure probes has given us in the past few years what has become really truly a cosmological paradigm. Okay? The beautiful fit of the microwave background fluctuation, temperature fluctuations here with a simple model has only 5 or 6 free parameters. Tell us, you know, a lot about the universe, and in particular, for the things we're interested in now, it tells us that the universe is dominated by today, at least by some form of dark energy, which is simply just a repulsive force that pushes, you know, galaxies apart. Dark matter, you know, some kind of fluid that interacts only with the rest of the universe through gravity and nothing else, and baryons, ordinary matter, which only makes up 5% or so of the total content of the universe. The bad thing about this is that it's kind of a pie of ignorance, and it's kind of embarrassing, really. It's a dark energy. I mean, I give this to public talks, and people say, put dark energy, dark matter. This is whole universe. We have no idea what it is. It's kind of embarrassing. For a good, now if you look at it from the half full glass perspective, this is a universe that is simple. Except for this pesky 95%, the rest is easy. Easy at least to simulate. This is just gravity, and this is just some kind of, you know, large-scale force. If you assume that this dark energy is just a cosmological constant, as you know, it appears to be at least very close to what it appears to be. So because of that, this universe can be simulated on computers. So we can simulate the large-scale structure of the universe expecting this with exquisite detail. And there has been, of course, some not only people like us in the Virgo Consortium, but many other groups around the world have devoted, you know, countless numbers of CPU hours to evolve, you know, from these initial conditions that are given to us by microwave background to today, the large-scale structure of the universe. This is an example. This is a structure on gigaparsec scales, whole, you know, Hubble radius, whole observable universe scales, to big, smaller scales, you know, the big, large galactic cluster here, to smaller scales, just a scale of, you know, a few hundred or 100 megaparsecs across, to individual objects. Like, you know, you can take one of these little white dots over here and blow it up. It looks like this, a galaxy halo. This one, for example, looked like this, galaxy cluster, a halo. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that if the universe was just dark matter and dark energy, we would have today, and it was cold dark matter, our particular paradigm, we'd have today a full characterization of what is the clustering of dark matter on all scales that are relevant to galaxies and extragalactic scales. So on large and small scales, in other words, we've been able to resolve these small little dark matter clumps we've been able to resolve dark matter clumps which are much smaller than the ones that contain galaxies. And of course, we've been able to resolve also or evolve things that are as big as the whole observable universe. So on all scales, we know the distribution of dark matter. We know more than that. We know, you know, how many of these things there are. We know where they are in the sky. We can characterize how they're, you know, in space. We know how they form, we know when these things collapse, we know statistically, we have a very good understanding of what is the, you know, the evolution of the large-scale structure in the universe in this particular paradigm, which is good because it means that we can also make predictions for things that are not observed. Once you fix, you know, the couple of free parameters, actually there are almost no free parameters once you take the microwave background, it's all set. Now we can make this You can take this paradigm to make predictions, especially on small scales. The scales are not constrained by the observations so far. Okay, so that is good in the sense that, you know, we have this excellent understanding of the development structure. The problem is that, of course, we are not don't observe dark matter. We don't observe dark energy directly either. So we need to make some kind of contact with the observations, and that's where I'm going to try to lead you in this. This talk and the kind of things that we're thinking about, problems or how we can learn about cosmology in this way. So let's start with things that we know, okay? So two or three, you know, basic things that we know about the large scale structure that I'll use later on. The one thing is that we can count. Okay? We can count these dark matter halos. You know, we can assign a mass, a root mass. You can see this is a bigger halo than this one, for example, than this one, etc. We can count them as a function of mass. We know how many there are in this particular paradigm per unit volume. In other words, we know the halo mass function. Okay, this is the nonlinear halo, is like a nonlinear, you know, clustering unit, if you want, of dark matter. Okay, so we know that very well. We know how many there are. There are fewer massive things than small mass things, but we know the shape, we know the normalization, we know everything. Okay, we know even the scatter from one volume to another. That's the one thing. So we know how to count. The other thing we learn is to take dark matter halos now, individual halos. Okay, and this is 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, something like, might contain something like the Milky Way, for example, our own galaxy. This is a 10 to the 15 solar mass halo, 1,000 times more massive than that one. Maybe wondering, the two things, of course, you know, they look very, very similar, and there's only been one rescaling been done here, and that is, you know, the size of the picture is adjusted to fit within the virial radius of a halo. That's the conventional size of a halo. Of course, a halo has no end, has no particular, you know, boundary or edge. So it's conventional in all the studies to define a radius, which of course defines the mass enclosed within the radius, which is the mass of the halo. And the way that this is done is that by this definition of virial radius, which is basically if you go from the center outwards and you ask, you know, if I take a circular orbit around, how long will it take to complete an orbit? That, of course, depends only on the mass enclosed and the radius. When you get to a radius where the circular orbit takes about the age of the universe, that is the real radius, by definition. The same thing here. Of course, the radius here in physical units is much bigger for this, right, than for this one. They've been rescaled. And once you rescale them, the two things that one thing is obvious. They look very much alike. If I could put 12, 10 to the 12 here and 15 there, you wouldn't be able to tell. So they look very much alike, and the similarity, you know, something that goes actually that's actually quite a strong result. This is one of them, and it's just the way in which mass is distributed within these halos. Okay, so let's go back to this picture. If you go to the center is very easy to find, so the densest region, and now go out and start measuring the density in units of as a function of radius in spherical shells. If you do that, you can make this plot, this log of density of dark matter, log of radius, and this is a big galaxy cluster, this is a small galaxy halo. And the thing about here is that, first, these things are not power laws. They actually have a very well, you know, curvature on them. Second thing is you can actually fit them with a very simple formula. It has only two free parameters. You can see this straight lines through them here. It doesn't matter exactly the particular form, but, you know, the other thing, because it has only two free parameters and two scaling parameters, it means that I can take a dwarf galaxy halo density profile, this one here. I can take this one. If I shift it down a bit and to the right, it will lie exactly on top of the other one. Okay? So in other words, in that sense, the mass profiles, the dark matter mass profiles are self-similar. You cannot tell apart. The shape is independent, except for the fact that, you know, more massive things are bigger. Except for that, the shape of them, of the density profile, is actually independent of mass, independent of many other things as well. And that's actually quite powerful. Okay? Let me just illustrate one way in which we'll use this. Notice, for example, because, you know, I take a small thing, I can shift it around and make it coincide with this, I can rescale a small halo to look like a big halo. It means that if I don't rescale it, they have to look different. Right? Sounds trivial, but it isn't from this point of view. You see, if you tell me the density anywhere, at any radius, I can tell you, these curves don't cross. I can tell the whole mass of the halo by one measurement. Okay? If you take, oh, the density at 1 megaparsec is this, 10 to the minus whatever, oh, it's this halo. It cannot be this one, it can be that one. It's the one. So I need only one measurement, and that's something we'll use. This curves down, it's like a Planck function, you know, Planck function that don't cross, and you can tell the radiance in any particular frequency and tell me the temperature. The same thing here. I tell the whole mass of halo by looking at one measurement, and that is actually important. The other thing is that this, they'll come handy later on, is that these profiles have the density keeps increasing towards the center. And the even higher simulation, the higher resolution simulations you make, the density seems to go higher and higher and higher, almost in a cusp. There's a lot of dark matter in the inner regions of the halo, which is where we think galaxies form. So we may have some ways of detecting that. And we'll get back to that later on. But the last thing you want to remember is that this particular, look at this halo here. I told you this is kind of the very radius of the halo. You see, it has a lot of structure in it. You know, it's not like a smooth thing. It has all these little knots of dark matter. This is gives you a bit of a biased view. If you ask, how much mass there is in all these little clumps, what's the fraction of the whole mass of the halo that's in these little clumps? Actually, the answer is about 5 to 10%. It's just that they're so dense, they're much denser than the surroundings. So if you weight your colors by density, of course, they appear they appear to feel a big volume, but actually a small amount. The other thing that's important is that the number of the substructures, or the subhalos, as we have to call them sometimes, is also independent of mass. If you rescale them to the mass of the halos, in other words, you say how many halos of this mass, the small mass, in units of the mass of the halo are there, that number is independent of the halo mass. Okay, so the scaled mass function, this is a bit more sophisticated measure of the mass, but it doesn't really matter. This is the scaled mass function. It's the same for clusters, dwarf galaxies, small halos, large halos, etc. So we can also use that, we'll use that to draw some interesting queries. The last thing we want to just to start making progress is the idea of where galaxies form. We're going to use the galaxies, the only thing we can observe, on large scale structure, on large scale large scales. So how are we going to use them? How do galaxies form? In this particular paradigm, to make the story simple, basically baryons, these 5%, somehow manage to get to the middle of the halo. They lose energy. They're a dissipative medium. They lose energy. Go to the middle. They settle into a disk, not unlike an accretion disk around a black hole or something, and you can start forming stars. So a galaxy is like this tiny little thing, this sea of dark matter around. Okay. The important thing to remember for the point of view of this particular talk is that you see every galaxy, every halo has a chance of having a galaxy in the middle. Okay. So one galaxy, one halo. And actually a subhalo will have also a little galaxy in it. So the subhalos you see will be the locations of the satellites of a galaxy like the Milky Way. Marginal cloud, for example, will live in one of these things, and Milky Way is here. One galaxy, one halo. Good, all right, so far. That's all we need to know to start making progress. So start making comparisons now. Okay, one galaxy, one halo, fine. Okay, I know how many halos there are given mass, so I can plot the mass function of halos. Think of this coordinate as mass, log mass, and this is the shape of the dark matter halo, a mass function, as I showed you before, which I told you we know very well. The normalization numbers, there are no changes here. Okay. Everyone who does the simulations know what they're doing, get the same results. So we'll say one galaxy, one halo. Let's compare that to the mass of a galaxy. Okay. The stellar mass of another galaxy, what we can measure, is luminosity, if you want, turning into mass in stars. And this is what that looks like. Okay. This is actually luminosity, but it doesn't change for the particular. It looks like this. You see the shapes are very different. And that gives us already clues and problems at the same time. If it's true that every halo has a galaxy, then how do these galaxies populate these halos? Okay. Clearly, the relation between galaxy mass and halo mass has to be very nonlinear. It cannot be one-to-one. It cannot be one proportional to the other, because otherwise the shapes would be exactly the same. So it has to be very different from linear. And presumably that is telling us something about the physics of galaxy formation, how you form stars, how the formation of stars and black holes regulate the the number of stars that a galaxy can form over its lifetime. So for example, over here, the very massive end, it is thought that the central galaxies don't grow as massive as they could in a cluster because the feedback processes, the energy output by the formation of supermassive black holes in the central cluster, central galaxies, in the galaxy's central clusters, prevent a lot of material to form into stars. At the very faint end, which is the part that we will be talking about a bit more, the scale dwarf galaxies, well, we think there are two processes that we think are important here. One is the reionization. You know, at some point, the universe reionizes. The formation of the first galaxies and the first black holes puts out enough ionizing photons, the whole universe becomes ionized. When it becomes ionized, basically, the temperature of the whole gas in the universe is raised to the ionization of energy, ionization energy of hydrogen, about 10 to the 4 Kelvin, and that puts a floor on the kinds of halos that are able to then collect baryons and form galaxies. And because of that, if your halo is very low mass, the gas is hot, it cannot collapse into this halo, and a lot of small mass halos become dark. They never form stars. That's one way of avoiding, you know, these huge numbers of low mass halos. You don't see as many dwarf galaxies as we see low mass halos. And that is, you know, one of our problems. We can go further, right? And beyond this, you know, and say, well, let's do a bit more quantitative. We can be more quantitative by saying the following: okay, how can we gain some more insight into this relation between galaxy mass and halo mass? We want us to match them by abundance. Okay? Although I don't know exactly what halos these galaxies over here, or this whatever this luminosity corresponds to, I know there are as many galaxies like this that there are as many halos as with this mass, so I can match them horizontally. I can say, oh, all these massive galaxies live in these massive halos. All these ones live in these ones. All these ones live in these ones. So I can match them horizontally. Then by definition, I will have, you know, a relation between galaxy mass and halo mass that will reproduce this particular shape. That is something called abundance matching, for those of you who haven't heard it. It's jargon, part of jargon in our field. And it's quite interesting. It tells you, look at this over here. This is very flat. It's very flat. It means that all of these galaxies, spanning a wide range in luminosities, live in halos of the same mass, if this is true, or very similar to the same mass. We can, of course, be more sophisticated than this. It's just the idea. We're more sophisticated than this, and this is actually, once you go into the details, include the subhalos, include the formation histories, etc. This is what you get for the relation between halo mass and galaxy mass. It's the stellar mass of the galaxy, it's the halo mass in which they live. This is the relation they must have, one relative to the other, in order to satisfy this galaxy's stellar mass function. Okay? And you can see it's very nonlinear, so it goes shallow here, there's a knee, and then it becomes very, very steep here. And this is what I was telling you, this is very steep over here. Yes, if you go from 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9, this only changes 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 11 or so. In other words, all of this very faint galaxy spanning, you know, this is 3 decades, for example, which is, you know, I don't know, 7, or I don't know how many, but almost 10 magnitudes in absolute magnitudes. All of these galaxies live in halos which are all very similar. Okay? And that is one interesting thing. Dwarf galaxies live in similar mass halos. One thing you want to remember. The other thing you want to remember is this. Because this is so steep, you see, you go to very faint luminosities at fairly large halo masses. So we're at 10 to the 10, let's take the blue line, for example, you're at 10 to the 6 solar masses already. This is the mass of a globular cluster, tiny little speck of stars in our own galaxy. This is a really, really faint galaxy. Okay. So you're already at 10 to the 10. So if you want to go to 10 to the 5, you'll be at 10 to the 10. You see, if you were at 10 to the 9, or 10 to the 8, those things should be dark. They shouldn't be, or the galaxies they host are so, so faint, we'll never see them. You can think of this very steep thing in extreme, you know, and very colloquial, as a kind of a threshold. Most galaxies that we know of, we can observe and in detail, live in halos which are more massive than 10 to the 10. Okay? The other ones are too faint. We know some examples of fainter things, but they're not very many and they're not very well studied because we can only see them very close to us. So think of galaxies forming in halos which are above a threshold of 10 to the 10 solar masses. So this already gives us some trouble here, okay? Just this idea. So I told you, all these galaxies, all these dwarf galaxies live in halos of the same mass. If they live in halos of the same mass because of the self-similarity, they all live in halos which are very similar in their mass profiles, for example. Those are similar in how they formed. But if that is true, then how does one reconcile the fact that dwarf galaxies are the most diverse objects we know of? Dwarf galaxies, you know, span a huge range of morphologies, a huge range of gas content, a huge range of stellar ages. In the two dwarf galaxies of the same mass, stellar mass, and some will have all the stars formed recently, all stars formed late, some all stars in between. Some will have lots of gas, some will have no gas whatsoever. So stars will be in disks, the stars will all be in spheroids. Where does that diversity come from? How is it that in dark matter, all these things are so similar, so self-similar, and in their observational problems, their properties, they look so different? So that's one thing. The other thing is that you know, they should shun these very low mass halos. There shouldn't be very many luminous galaxies, like ones we see here, that live in low mass halos. And the last thing is that, you know, when you go to very faint galaxies, by definition, they have few stars. That is why they're faint. But they're very faint and they have very few stars, and they all live in the same halo. It means that the energy that was produced by the stars that formed, because they're very few, was not very much. Okay. So feedback, what we call feedback, you know, the energy output from the generation of stars that form, cannot be very important in very faint galaxies because there are not many stars. Okay. So why is it that they are so faint then? It's not feedback then. It must be something else that's doing it. You see, there are a bunch of conundrums that are posed just by this diversity. The other one is to say, okay, well, if it's not feedback, then oh, it's renization. Renization, you know, puts all the gas at the same temperature, as I said, in the whole universe at redshift 10 or so. All the gas at the same temperature, and therefore, you know, that prevents a lot of, you know, low mass halos from forming stars. But if that is true, and renization is what, you know, determines all this, then in dwarfs, you should see an obvious signature. For example, you expect all of the dwarfs to stop forming stars at the same time. That's when renization hits the gas. And that's not true, right? I just told you. These are the most diverse objects. Some form stars early, some late, and there's absolutely no signature, or very little signature, of these effects that we're calling upon in order to make sense of this cosmology with observations of dwarfs. Yeah. Well, all of them have formed through many mergers overall, right?
Yeah. So how many of them have experienced merger with another guy comparable mass to the current mass?
The history of accretion of halos is actually also scale free. So if you test, you say, what is the mass spectrum of things that merge to form one halo? That mass spectrum, of course, relative to the in units of the final mass, is all the same. What changes, though, is the time when this happens. Okay, so a cluster actually forms in exactly the same way as a dwarf galaxy. It's just that dwarf galaxy formed earlier. Major mergers are not very frequent, just to give an idea. I would say, yeah, almost every halo has had a merger with one halo about 20% of its mass. That's the biggest thing that usually happens. Okay. Of course, other things can also happen, but they're more pathological. Almost every halo has encountered at least a 1 to 5 merger in the history. Okay. In a cluster, of course, you know, this is happening right now, and that's why all these galaxies are still spread apart. In a dwarf, we think that all these things happened very early on, and that's why all the things have gone to the middle. So that's another thing. Yep. We will get to that, hopefully.
The mass range that you could are mostly from lensing.
From lensing, I'll get to that. I mean, just to make a long story, I'll get to that at the end. But I'll tell you now, the way that we determine masses for these things are by rotation velocities. Okay, so imagine a disk like this. This is a disk, you know, that's spinning around. We have a measure of the rotation speed at a particular radius. Okay, we assume it's a circular orbit. That gives a measure of the enclosed mass. That gives us one mass within one radius. And if you go, remember what I said at the beginning, I need just one measurement. That tells me the whole mass of the halo, with some scatter, you know, with some corrections one can make. But that's the idea. The masses here, especially with dwarfs, are all estimated typically from rotation speeds or stellar velocity dispersions. Any other questions? No? All right. Let's move on. This list of, you know, this litany of things that I told you, you know, go, they have different names in the literature. You'll see things like, say, oh, the too big to fail problem, the missing satellites problem, satellite alignment problem, the diversity problem, the Casper versus Core problem. All the reflections of the same ideas. And I'll try to explore a few of these in this talk. So I'm sure I'll run out of time. So before I go through maybe three of the six, but so be it. Let's start with this idea of the mass of the halos. Something you can test, right? You can say, oh, all these halos, even halos have the same mass. And as I said, if you measure the mass inside any radius, and measure the mass of the halo. So that should be fairly simple. Let's see what that means, okay? So this is what I was just telling you. So this is the rotation curve, as we call it, of a dwarf galaxy, one that has a disk of gas going around, more single orbits. You can measure the rotation speed at different radii, correct by inclination, those sorts of little tricks like that. And then you get a measure of the rotation speed, of the speed of a circular orbit at a given radius, a very different radius, several different radii. That's the rotation curve. It's this red thing here for galaxy, just E7599. Interestingly, okay, these galaxies, when they go to the dwarf, something I haven't said, they're almost all dominated by dark matter. Their baryons, if you ask what's the contribution of the baryons to the total mass, it's actually negligible. So when you look at the rotation curves to zeroth order, you're seeing just the dark matter. So you can compare directly with this kind of profiles that I was telling about. Now, instead of now density as a function of radius, which is the way I motivated the similarity, now we're doing something similar. Instead of density, this is the integral of the density. It's the enclosed mass divided by r square root. That's the cyclic velocity. The enclosed mass divided by r. Square root, that gives us cyclic velocity. That's a function of radius. What I told you before, if two things have the same different masses, they should be different. They should have different curves. Okay. So this is a curve corresponding to a 10 to the 9 solar mass halo. This is a curve corresponding to a 10 to the 10 solar mass halo. And 10 to the 11 would be higher. And 10 to the 12, of course, would be even higher. These curves also don't cross. So if we tell them you can measure the rotation speed anywhere, you know the mass of the halo. Well, that's easy then. All I have to do is go to a dwarf galaxy, measure rotation speed in just one radius, and that radius is usually the outermost part because the inner regions, see, the velocities are very small. Very small, they're very hard to measure. Okay? So, but only in one radius. So I can go here, the outermost point, and measure the rotation speed. Let's look at this galaxy. What do we expect? I said all these dwarfs should live in halos 10 to the 12 and above. So you see all these curves should lie to above this 10 to the 10 solar mass, right? Should be higher than 10 to the 10, they should all be above 10 to the 10. This one's actually not too bad, okay? This 7559, it's actually kind of hugs around the curve of 10 to the 10. This will be at the edge of what we expect. This is actually not too bad. But we can do this, of course, for many galaxies in the local universe now, even very faint galaxies. And we expect them all to lie above this curve, this 10 to the 10 solar mass curve. And again, we're only in one point, which is the most robust one is the outermost one. So let me show you this for a sample of galaxies in the local universe. These are very dwarf galaxies, you know, going to 10 to the 6 solar masses, as I was saying before. And this again, this is the 10 to the 10 solar mass, this shaded region here. It has now a shaded, there's some scatter, of course, and now it's been taken into account here, going beyond just a simple motivation. Well, you see some of these dwarfs are actually okay with these predictions. These are the outermost point again. But some are not. There are many galaxies actually that appear to live in halos which are much lower mass than the halos for which we had this particular threshold. So what is going on? How can we explain this? See, it's a problem because imagine this. So this is 5 × 10^38. So this galaxy will live in a 10^9 solar mass halo. The problem is that these 10^9 solar mass halos are so abundant that if every 10 to the 9 solar mass halo had a galaxy with this brightness, the number of dwarfs should be huge. And the luminosity function would not be flat, would just be, you know, steeply rising. That's something we don't observe. So something is failing in the whole argument that I gave you at the beginning, right? In this abundance matching argument. Something is not right. Or cold dark matter is not right. That's another, of course, possibility you should want to keep in the back of your mind. I'll try to give you some ideas. This actually has been already has been pointed out in different ways. There's another way of saying the same thing from papers, recent paper by Manolis Papastergis and the Alfalfa collaboration. And what they do here is actually look at the width of the velocity of this of the rotation curves that I mentioned. You see, if all these halos, if all the dwarfs live in galaxies of the same mass, they should all have the same velocity. If they all have the same velocity, then when you count them as a function of velocity, you should see a very sharp peak here. There's all increase. And they don't. This is as flat as the luminosity function. There's no preferred velocity for dwarf galaxies. In other words, there's no preferred mass for dwarf galaxies. And the whole argument they constructed at the beginning was based on the idea that there is a preferred mass for dwarf galaxies. So basically, that is where part of the trouble. The masses are difficult to understand. You can do the same kind of argument and apply now to the satellites of the Milky Way. And the argument is actually a similar argument. It goes to the following way. In the satellites of the Milky Way, if you exclude, you know, the Magellanic Clouds, which are, you know, big galaxies, take all the dwarf spheroidals, as they call them, small galaxies like Draco, Fornax, Ursa Minor, the one I showed at the beginning, that you call them barely see. You just see individual stars. Those guys actually don't have any gas. They don't have any gas, but still, you know, they have stars. We can measure the radial velocities of the stars. With radial velocities of the stars and the spatial distribution, we can manage to measure the total mass inside a particular radius, inside the radius that contains the stars, typically. So we know the mass within one radius, and that's all we need. We can express that mass, divide by r, take a square root, express it in terms of circular velocity, and these are the data for different galaxies. And these are the predictions from the dark matter. You see, this is now mass of the halo expressed in kilometers per second. That's another parameter. This is low mass, higher mass, higher mass, higher mass. Okay. So in the halo of the Milky Way, you say, this galaxy over here, Ursa Minor, live in a halo of about 24 kilometers per second. This galaxy over here, Sextans, lives in a halo of 12 kilometers per second. Well, that's fine. Now, the problem comes when you start looking at this one, 40 kilometers per second, or above, say, above 30. Okay. How many halos do you have above 30 kilometers per second? The answer is about 8. Okay. How many satellites do we have above 30 kilometers per second? Observed ones. Well, we had the LMC and the SMC, those are big galaxies. And maybe Sagittarius, and other galaxies kind of being disrupted. 3 at most. So we have 8 of these gray things and above, and none of them seem to be populated by luminous galaxies. So what happened to them? Why didn't these big halos, big subhalos, form galaxies? How is it that a 12 kilometer per second halo, a tiny little one, was able to form stars, and this big one gray here wasn't able to? You see, these are big subhalos that have failed to form stars. Right? Too big to fail, that's where the name that Mike Boylan-Colchin coined for this. But it's the same arguments, right? In other words, galaxies like to live in low mass halos and somehow appear to shun some of the biggest objects. So this is the situation, basically. And we decided to try to study this in a sort of controlled environment. You see, a lot of this data comes from very local samples. These are very faint galaxies. We're only observing down to a few megaparsecs, not farther. And the satellites, of course, only a few hundred kiloparsecs at most. Or maybe the Andromeda galaxy. Those are only examples. So there is the possibility that there are local biases in the universe. And that's why we started this project called the Local Groups Simulation Project, where we've taken, you know, a big cosmological volume, and we select the regions which resemble the local group in many ways. In the fact that there are two main halos, the big galaxies like M31, Andromeda, and us, they're approaching a particular velocity at this particular distance, etc. They try to match the environment of the local group as best as possible and re-simulate this. Okay. And we have about 12 of these candidates. We simulated with a code that has been shown to give a very good representation of the galaxy population as a whole. That's the code that was used for the Eagle project. I'll show you just one example of that. And the Eagle simulation is actually one of several kind big simulations that people have completed recently. Another one is the Illustris simulation. You may have heard of this. It was on the news a few months ago. Another one is massive black simulation. These are big cosmological boxes simulated with, you know, hydrodynamics, star formation, feedback, all those reionization, all those recipes, and they try to match the galaxy population as a whole. I show you just the result for Eagle, so I'm involved with it. Actually, no, this is Illustris. These are the kinds of galaxies you see. This is Illustris, this is Eagle. You see galaxies. Now, the ones are big, and the simulations are actually quite realistic. You see they form disk galaxies like this ones, galaxies with bars, you know, interacting galaxies. The same over here, and they have elliptical galaxies, you know, spheroidal galaxies, disk galaxies, etc. So this is where in a regime where these codes are now able to match with reasonable assumptions about these feedback processes that I mentioned, the whole population of galaxies. This is one example. This is an example of the stellar mass function. This is galaxy stellar mass. This is the number density. This is the data, the circle, the open and closed circles. And this is the result of the simulation. You see, these codes are able to reproduce the galaxy population as a whole. They don't overproduce low mass galaxies or big mass galaxies, etc. But of course, this is done only down to 10^38 or so, 10^39 solar masses in stars. And we're looking at things over here, much fainter than that, but down to 10^6 or so. So we can do this now. We can extend those results, go into lower mass, smaller volumes, and the local group volume. I'll give an example of how this looks. This is a local group analog in the dark matter. This will be the M31 or the Milky Way. This will be the other one. So the two main halos, they're approaching today at about 120 kilometers per second. They're separated by 800 kiloparsecs. It doesn't match. So we found these halos. We found them intentionally in big volumes, and then we re-simulated that volume. You see, they live in this kind of filament of dark matter, which will come handy in a minute. Okay. This is what they're looking in dark matter. This is what it looks in gas. The gas fills their halos. You can see very obvious, you know, tails of gas being stripped, you know, by run pressure, as satellites fall in, the large-scale filaments of gas, etc. It varies a lot. This is just colored by density, but it varies a lot. You know, the low density here with 10^6 Kelvin, this is the disk of the forming stars with 10^4. The hottest things are 10^6, coolest things are 100 Kelvin. So it's a big. This is just a color by density, not by temperature. Yeah. That is what is done, yeah. You take the fluctuations in spectrum, similar to that, you mimic that initial fluctuation spectrum, and then you assume that at the very early times, the baryons and the dark matter were just shared the same fluctuation spectrum. Okay? And then you evolve this. Of course, then the nonlinear evolution is different. The dark matter just clusters because of gravity. The baryons cluster and do other things. You know, they have pressure gradients, they have hydrodynamical shocks, they have radiative losses, they come from stars once they go to the center of these halos, etc. So they become very, very different. And you see how different now. Look at this, is dark matter. Okay? And this is the stars. This is the gas that became dense at some point, was able to form stars. You see a hugely biased, you know, view of the local group if you don't look at the stars. But this is really all we can look at. Only very few halos of the thousands of halos that exist have been able to be populated with stars. Right, right. And you see, if you look at the, in other words, you look at the if you look at the stars only, the local group, you get a hugely biased impression of what it should be. It has to be that way, all right? There cannot be as many dwarf galaxies as there are dark matter halos. Otherwise, we overproduce them by huge amounts. So this is actually quite interesting, because now I can actually do something. And we can compare a simulation that was done only with dark matter, and a simulation that was done with dark matter and all these processes. Okay. One thing I failed to point out, is that a lot of these problems that like this abundance matching, all these issues, that all are motivated by simulation of dark matter only. Okay. So we take simulation of dark matter, and then we try to make contact with the observations. This simulation, in principle, we can look at them directly. Like count satellites, count galaxies directly. You don't need to, you know, assume some conversion between the dark matter halo and one thing that actually is interesting and that shows up is, look at this panel only over here. And this is kind of this function that goes at 1, and then it drops down to 0 very quickly. This is actually the fraction of halos that have luminous galaxies. You can see it's all around 1 at large masses, so every galaxy has a halo. But as soon as you go below, you know, 10 to the 10 or so, this number is plummeting. This is a log scale here. You go to 10 to the 8, for example, only 1 in 10 halos has a galaxy. What is the what? Sorry? There are many curves here. Look at only the blue one. The pink one is actually when you don't include reionization. Okay. If you don't include reionization, then everything goes 1-to-1, except here at the tail of the low resolution. Okay. So all it will turn over at some point. If you look at the blue ones, actually, you see that they all come down quite dramatically. So reionization, once you include it, is able to prevent the formation of stars, but it actually selects some halos. Some halos are able to form stars, some halos are not able to form stars. And those seem to correspond to the ones that were able to collapse earlier than the redshift for reionization. Okay. And that the importance of this is that when you go to, say, low masses, you see only a few of these halos have stars. And that is something that was not accounted for in the simple abundance matching exercise that I did at the beginning. I assumed every halo had a galaxy. Now, if I assume that not every halo has a galaxy, but that there is a decreasing fraction of them that does, then I can redo the calculation for abundance matching and recompute the relation between halo mass and stellar mass. And you see now that's different. This is what you'd have predicted if every halo had a galaxy, and this is what you actually observe with a bunch of dots scattered as well. You see, it lies above this. In other words, now you're able to populate low-mass halos with visible galaxies, okay, in about the numbers that you observe, at least in the local group. There are many symbols here. So all you want to, I want to, at this particular point, is to show that the mean of this goes above. Halos correspond to either centrals or satellites in the simulations, over here. And the other ones are actually data from the satellites of Milky Way and M31 or dwarf irregulars in the field, also of the local universe. Yeah?
If these objects have to form earlier, doesn't that suggest that they have to make their stars earlier and then all those stars
would
get
old? That is what people thought. People thought, oh, that is what reionization does. You know, it should put, you know, it should constrain all stars to form very early on. And that should be the signature. And that is not what you observe. At the beginning, that's how I discussed at the beginning. That's not what you observe. I have a whole talk I can give you on this, the effects of reionization on dwarfs. I wasn't planning to go in that direction. But the short answer to this would be not necessarily. Okay. I could digress a bit. But take a halo, okay, that today is massive, and let's go back to reionization. Think of reionization now as a process that has a well-defined time, the time when reionization happens, and a well-defined mass, in the sense that it has a well-defined temperature of the gas. All right? If the halo, the one we found today, the halo is today massive, but at that time, maybe imagine the halo was so low mass that it wasn't able to excite, you know, line cooling. In other words, its virial temperature is below Laman alpha, 10 to the 4 Kelvin. Okay? So it was low mass halo at that time. The gas couldn't cool. couldn't cool, it couldn't form stars. Realization happens, heats the gas, it pushes part of the gas out, but the gas stays there. Later on, much later on, when the halo becomes massive enough, that gas goes above this threshold, 10 to the 4 Kelvin, it can excite line cooling and form stars. But it forms stars only late. And it forms stars late because they didn't form stars earlier. Take another galaxy, take another halo of the same mass today, but it was above that threshold. So above that threshold means you form stars early. Form stars early, reionization happens, and you have two sources of feedback. Reionization, or heating, reionization, and the feedback from the stars that formed. So you see, you expect two families, galaxies, dwarfs, that form only stars early, and dwarfs that form only stars late. And there's actually something that you see in the dwarf galaxy record. If you put all the galaxies together, and you look at the star formation history of all the galaxies averaged together, there's a big gap in the middle. The formation of stars in intermediate times is discouraged for some reason in the local universe. So actually, the effect of reionization is indirect, okay, but it's not inconsistent with what I'm saying. It's funny. I had the same prejudice when I was looking at this and say, well, reionization should always stop the formation of stars early on. That's not the case. Actually, it delays them in some cases, and it stops in some, it delays in the others. And it gives this gap in the middle. I could, as I said, I have too many slides already, but I can show them some later if you're interested. So let me go back to this. So this has been then a way of populating then low mass halos below this 10 to the 10 with visible galaxies, which is what we want, and making these things. You can say, does this work quantitatively? Can I explain how many satellites there are in the Milky Way, et cetera? And the answer is yes. These are the results of simulation directly. Now this is stellar mass, and this is the numbers of satellites you predict for M31 and the Milky Way, and numbers of galaxies altogether within a couple of megaparsecs from the barycenter of the local group. And you see that the data is these lines, the colors are the results of the simulation. You see they're all in reasonably good agreement. There are no missing satellites in the simulations. We have as many galaxies as we observe. Okay, so that's Now, that's not enough, as I said at the beginning, because of this too big to fail. Not only we know how many dwarf galaxies there are, we know what halo masses they live in. And as I said at the beginning, that there were many sub-halos that were too massive. Okay, this was a too big to fail problem. You can see it here. This is the same data I showed you before. This is circular velocity, radius here. You can see here, these are the data from the satellites. And this is the result of a simulation, actually our local group simulations, that does not have any hydro. It's just dark matter and nothing else. You can see there are many curves that go above those observed lines, about 8 per halo. And we could have at most 3. But it's interesting, when you go through the dark matter only to the simulations that have hydro and all this stuff, these curves change. And now all the circular velocities here are depressed. You don't see these things above that were discrepant with this. All the circles have gone away. Only maybe 2 in this case remain. Why has that happened? In other words, why is the potential, well, this is velocity, so it's a measure of the potential well depth. Why are the potential wells lower than in the case of the same simulations? This is the same simulation, same initial conditions, in the case of dark matter only. The reason is because baryons are actually not negligible. Baryons make out 20%. It's 5% of the whole thing, but it's 5% of 25%. Dark matter is only, dark matter to baryon ratio is only 1 to 5. If this is a simulation that assumes that all the matter is called dark matter, when you put 20% in baryons, and these baryons are lost at the beginning because of reionization and these winds and all this feedback that we talked about, the halos grow with 20% less mass for the whole history of the universe. And therefore, their potential wells are lower as a result. How much lower? About 20% in velocity, which is enough to actually bring these numbers down to levels that are consistent with the observations. I'll show this in this plot. This is estimates of the circular velocity of the halos in which the satellites live compared with the simulations. These are simulations that I just showed you, and these are the elements, the Lagrangian clouds, Draco, Sagittarius, etc. You can see that this curve is in fairly good agreement with this other one. It's actually not in agreement with this. This one is the one that comes from the dark matter only case. The correction is actually small in terms of velocity, but it's big in terms of numbers because these curves are so steep. So I take this curve, shift it a bit to the left, and then you match the data. So the problem that people have pointed out is this one here. You see, you have about 10 with this velocity, but you expect about 20 or 30. But no, actually, when you make the correction, the velocities are lower, the numbers actually agree fairly well. All right, let me... Yeah, they look to be a bit bigger than, but you know, it's one and two out of this. This is a cumulative fraction. So these are, of course, you know, we have some cases where we have it, but the scatter here of one, what is the most massive or the brightest satellite, of course, you know, changes dramatically from case to case. We only have 12 cases where, and we'll have one Milky Way as well. So it is, I wouldn't worry about these points over here. You worry about these points over here. This is the discrepancy that one worried about. Yeah. Right, let me end with skipping this a bit. Let me end with just one problem that I think is that this one's I think that we can more or less solve. The problem that I'm not sure we can solve is the Kasparov's core problem, which I started thinking about recently again. So let me show you what the Kasparov's core problem is first, okay? Dwarf galaxies, okay? These are dwarf galaxies. This is Homburg 2, for example. This is dwarf galaxy. This is a rotation curve for Homburg 2. This is the prediction from cold dark matter. And this is this thin line is one of our halos in the simulations that I mentioned. You see, there is no problem. This seems to fit relatively well. And there are actually many galaxies like this. First thing you learn about this Kasparov's core problem, not all galaxies are a problem. So this galaxy is actually perfectly consistent with the data. This other one is not. Okay? These galaxies actually have similar velocities out here. So similar masses in the outer regions, but the mass profiles inside are very different. So if this one is consistent, this is not. See, the problem is one of diversity. The problem is that if you take two dwarf galaxies that have the same mass within a given radius, the outer parts, their inner mass profiles differ greatly from one to another. Although the prediction of cold dark matter is that they all should look the same. This is the problem. This is the Kasparov's core problem. See, it's not really a Kasparov core. It's just the fact that there is less mass in the inner regions than what you'd expect from cold dark matter. You can see this in this example. These are four galaxies of the same cyclic velocity in the outer regions, the same stellar mass, same baryonic mass altogether. But look at their velocity profile. So they all have the same mass. By definition, out here, about 10 kiloparsecs have the same mass, about 8 to 80, 90 kilometers per second. But look at this one. This is actually has more mass than cold dark matter, we predict. This has about the right amount. This has a bit less. This has a lot less. Two things to learn from here. This all has the same mass, as I said. Why? Where does the diversity come from? How is it that this galaxy managed to, you know, bring or to have more material in the inner region of this than this one, although they have the same mass outside? And the differences are not small, right? Think of this. Look at this. This is, look at, say, 1 kilometer per second, 2 kilometers per second. This has a velocity of about 20, 15. These are 20, a 2 kilometer per second has a velocity of 70, 80. These are, square that, you get a difference. This is a difference in mass at 2 kiloparsecs of factors of 20, although they have the same mass in the other parts. Where does that difference come from? One thing you learn is that you cannot solve this problem by appealing to, say, other models of dark matter. So you go to models that self-interact in dark matter or something like that has, you know, a core. But they should all look like this. You shouldn't see things like this or like that. Right? We don't have a huge sample. I'll show you the whole sample in a. Let me just show it. Let me show this with the last plot, then we can chat about it. What I'll show you to make the point is the velocity in the outer parts, the maximum velocity, versus the velocity at, say, 1 kiloparsec. Okay? If it's cold dark matter, what you expect is a very good correlation between the two numbers. Okay? If you tell me the velocity here, I'll tell the velocity here. Okay? You expect a very good correlation. So that's what you expect. This is the correlation. So maximum velocity, velocity at 1 kiloparsec. This is the correlation you expect. With a bit of scatter, you can actually compute the scatter from the simulation. This is all gases should be around here, or maybe above, because you know the variance can raise the total mass inside the 1 kiloparsec. Maybe above. And this is what the data look like. Not this, the blue ones. Instead of being on this line over here or maybe above, there are many, many below. Actually, the worrying thing is that they're so far below. Look at these ones over here. Look, compare this at 80 kilometers per second. We have things that have velocities of 10 to compared to almost 100. Where does the diversity come from? These galaxies have the same velocity, the same stellar mass. They differ a little bit in their morphology and things, but nothing dramatic. How is it that they're inner mass has changed so much? And also, why is it so much lower than the dark matter to begin with? These galaxies somehow formed and were able to reduce their mass in the inner regions by whatever, factors of 5 or 10. And why some did it, why some did not do it? These red things are some of the best attempts that people you find in the literature. But people said, oh, we found the core in the profiles. And there is a good argument as to why they cannot go below this red line here. So all these ones, even big galaxies, these are galaxies that have more than 100 kilometers per second, seem to be affected by this problem. So to me, this is not something that has been resolved yet. But it points to, I mean, it's best seen as a fact that one expects similarity between the profiles of dwarfs, and one sees something like this, a huge diversity in the mass profiles of these objects when they all should be self-similar if cold dark matter were the dominant form of matter in these galaxies. So let me stop here. It's about time, so thank you very much. In some cases, you do. But as I said, if you actually take all of the matter, if you compare the actual, for example, this one is a higher surface brightness than this one. So you could see a difference. But the problem is that the fraction of the mass in stars here and here is irrelevant in both cases.
I don't mean in the context of dark matter or just overall rotation, but I mean, right. Then if, say, you had dark disks in the larger halos, then you could presumably expect a similar diversity in the kinds of dark disks that you could form. So wouldn't that still give you the possibility of some self-interacting dark matter?
By dark disks, what do you mean? Sorry.
Like, so suppose dark matter has some sort of dissipative dynamics. So you could form a dark disk on top of a visible disk. And then if there's diversity in visible disks, just in terms of how their masses cluster, then presumably you could expect
There is some diversity. I mean, I haven't seen, you know, there is some diversity in the profiles. The way I think about the argument is that the luminous part looks different, but it is irrelevant to the total mass in all cases. So that cannot be part of the answers, right? So somehow the dark matter, well, we are seeing the dark matter, and dark matter is different. The distribution of dark matter is different. So no simple model that will give you a particular profile for a given halo mass scale, like cold dark matter, will work. We have to change it somehow. Cold dark matter makes one prediction, these black lines. You need to change it. Assume some self-interacting dark matter might give you this prediction here, like the blue one. But then why do you have things like this and like that? Sorry, so
maybe my question wasn't clear, but when I look at the number of different visible matter
Right.
So forgetting velocities. Just
right.
We can see how much matter there is in the visible stuff. And we know that lots of galaxies are very, very different, just in terms of how their visible matter is distributed. And that's
right.
Because of the dynamics in the standard model.
Right.
So if dark halos, say, had two components, there's one component that looks very much like cold dark matter, but there's another component that has enough dissipative dynamics that it forms its own disk. So if you have a visible disk, a dark disk, and then a CDN-like halo,
right.
Then presumably the diversity among the dark disks, which would match the diversity of the visible disks, could give you a handle to resolve.
I find that a bit contrived, but I think it's possible. Yeah, that's basically, it cannot be cold dark matter. It cannot be cold dark matter. It has to be something different, and you have to be able to tune these parameters in a way that gives you this kind of result. And it isn't obvious to me. I mean, I'm not saying it cannot be done. I'm just saying it has not been done yet. That was my only. James?
Mm-hmm. So, you used to worry about whether these things, whether you're tracing the dynamics properly, and whether, for instance, you have a bar or warps.
Yeah.
Do you worry about that at all with the ball and right hand panel?
I'm more of a theorist, so I always worry with data. But the data, this is the best data that exists now. These are all 2D velocity fields, so sometimes they combine, many different tracers. I think the observers from the time I wrote papers on this ages ago have, I think, cleaned up their act a lot. I was telling over lunch some people, I wrote a paper on this kind of things the last time Argentina defaulted on their debt. And now I'm writing another one here the same year that Argentina is again defaulting on its debt. So. Hopefully, I won't be able to write many papers on this topic. Maybe the last, hopefully, it'll be the last one for a long time. But otherwise, the whole country will go to financial. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, any other questions? All right. Thanks.
What do you see here for maybe
20 more minutes? Yeah.